Does something called cavity shaving help reduce the need for reoperation for breast cancer?
Does lowering cholesterol improve outcome of people at risk for a heart attack?
What happens to people with type 2 diabetes over the long haul?
And breast cancer screening.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 5th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
So Rick, I revealed to you already before we started recording that I was fortunate enough to talk with someone here at Johns Hopkins who's head of breast surgery about this study, taking a look at this technique called cavity shaving. That's in this week's New England Journal of Medicine.
Okay, Elizabeth, so I'll set it up. So in women that have received a diagnosis of early stage breast cancer, many of them opt to have breast conserving surgery. That is, they have a partial mastectomy. It appears that the survival rate with partial mastectomy surgery is equivalent as having a total mastectomy or total breast removal. However, what's critical to that is whether the surgical margins are free of disease. That is, the edges that are resected. The question is what we're currently doing adequate, or can we improve upon that by taking out a little bit more tissue than originally planned, and that's called shaving or shaving the margins. And to set that up, they took 235 patients with early stage breast cancer that were scheduled to undergo partial mastectomy, and they had the surgeons perform the regular type of surgery. And if they felt like there was something near the edge, they would actually take out a little bit more. At that point, they randomized the patients and said, okay, if the surgeon thinks that he's already gotten all the cancer out, how likely is it that there's still some residual cancer in the margin? The other half of women, despite the surgeons thinking, I got it all, they asked them to shave more, and they evaluated the rate of margin disease, and secondly is how often did the surgeon have to go back in for a second surgery if the margins weren't free of disease. And what they discovered is that with the initial surgery in both groups, about a third of the patients still had disease right at the margin. The women that went on to receive shaving, they lowered that subsequent risk from about a third to about 19%. And furthermore, there was a lower rate of need for a second surgery, 21% in those with the usual care, and only 10% of those that had shaving performed. So Elizabeth, what did you all talk about when you talked about the details of this particular study?
Exactly the same kind of data, that the cavity shaving technique actually reduces both the need for reoperation by about 50%. So that's pretty good. In the interview that I conducted, I also learned that a lot of this depends on the size of the tumor and the size of the surgical defect that's created. Because if too much of a defect is created, then there are other considerations like symmetry of the breasts subsequent to the procedure.
And that's a good point. So they actually measured the amount of tissue taken out, and they looked at complication rates and whether there was any cosmetic differences. And what they discovered is with the shaving, they took out about 50% more tissue. And you're right, the larger the tumor, that means the larger amount of tissue that's taken out. But there was no difference in complications. There was no change in the need for complicated surgery to reconstruct. So overall, it suggests that once the surgeon thinks he's gotten it all out, take a little bit more tissue lowers the rate of both margin positivity and also need for reoperation.
Excellent. And also, I guess I would say that this study supports the idea that breast conservation is an absolutely reasonable goal with regard to disease recurrence.
And certainly for early stage cancer, that's true.
Right. So this whole movement toward bilateral total mastectomy and reconstruction is something that we ought to look at a little bit more carefully, because that usually does result in a lot more operations that are necessary.
And Elizabeth, that's often done in people that have a genetic predisposition, an early family history, and done as a type of cancer prevention. And obviously that's been in the news because we've had some high profile individuals that have taken that course of action.
Right. But for many women, of course, breast conservation works just great. Let's move from here then. We're staying in the New England Journal of Medicine. We're giving them kudos. Wow, the studies were outstanding. Let's take a look at breast cancer screening recommendations.
I thought it was important to look at this again, Elizabeth, because this has generated a tremendous amount of controversy. This report was generated from a group that met in November 2014. These are experts from 16 different countries. This group had issued breast cancer screening recommendations in 2002. And so this is an update, and it's based upon additional studies. It's based upon better screening techniques. They looked at all the studies, randomized control trials, observational studies, cohort studies, to provide guidelines based upon the evidence regarding the beneficial and also the adverse effects of different methods of screening for breast cancer. I'll just summarize some of their conclusions. There is sufficient evidence to show that mammography reduces breast cancer mortality in women between the ages of 50 and 74, but there's really limited evidence to suggest that routine mammography is beneficial in younger ages. With regard to using ultrasonography, this is in women that have particularly dense breasts, there's really no good evidence to show that it reduces breast cancer mortality. It actually increases the false positive rate. And there's really insufficient evidence to suggest that in high-risk women that MRI offers any benefit over mammography.
Of course, the other really salient question here is, what about the interval for screening in women 50 to 74?
Well, that's a great question. This group came to the conclusion is that there wasn't enough data to make firm recommendations about what that interval should be.
Interesting. Well, clearly what this points to, at least for me, is the need for a better screening technique, perhaps some way of assessing tumors to see whether or not they really are going to be bad actors, or whether we can just employ watchful waiting as we do with prostate cancer a lot of the time.
Better screening techniques, better identification of which populations, and more importantly, avoiding it in populations where we know it's not beneficial.
Now let's turn to another really common issue, type 2 diabetes, and let's take a look at long-term follow-up after treatment.
This comes to the issue of the benefits, if any, of intensive sugar control in people that have type 2 diabetes versus less intensive control. This particular study is a follow-up on one that was reported earlier, the Veterans Affairs Diabetes Trial. They reported that intensive glucose lowering, as compared to standard therapy, did not significantly reduce the rate of major cardiovascular events, heart attacks and strokes. This is a follow-up. The individuals that were involved in that study, they asked them whether they would still want to continue to be followed up. About 78% said, yes, we'd like to be continued. And that follow-up continued for the course of 10 years. What they discovered is that there was about 8.5 major events prevented per 1,000 person years. But the most important thing is, did it reduce deaths? And the answer was, it did not.
And of course, now we have to talk about, well, the consequences of treatment. How onerous was it for people to be able to stay on these intensive glucose lowering regimens?
Well, many people found it difficult to do so. For people that had very label disease, the use of these medications can sometimes cause hypoglycemia. Some of them can cause kidney disease and other issues as well. So for decades, we thought, well, since high sugars are associated with worse outcome, the more intensively we control the sugar, the better the major outcomes will be. And although it does reduce minor vascular disease, things like it does reduce blindness, it does reduce kidney disease, that's very important, no question about it. But in terms of major outcomes, intensive glucose control really does not improve overall outcomes.
Another one of those a priori conclusions that, when subjected to rigorous scrutiny, turns out to not be the case.
Yeah, this caught many of us by surprise that for decades thought that we were doing the right things for patients.
I guess the other complicating factor I would add to this is that, as we've been able to observe, when we take a look at people as they age, just like with hypertension, glucose increases and we need to relax those guidelines a little bit. So I think that's a complicating factor here.
I agree.
Finally, I'm going to let you serve up the last study.
This is based upon the LDL hypothesis. That is the concept that the higher your LDL cholesterol, the more likely you are to have heart disease or atherosclerosis and stroke. The whole issue about how do we treat and follow cholesterol was kind of turned upside down when the recommendations came out about a year and a half ago saying, gosh, we don't really target a specific LDL cholesterol level. We just say, are you at high risk or low risk? And we either give you high intensity or low intensity. Well, this was a study that was conducted in people that are at high risk for having a heart attack. They presented with what's called an acute coronary syndrome. They didn't have a heart attack, but they're at risk for it. And these patients are all treated with a statin. But in those that are already on a statin, if we add a second non-statin cholesterol-lowering medication, ezetimibe, which lowers the LDL cholesterol another 25%, does that actually improve outcomes? And they follow them over the median follow-up of 6 years. Those that receive both the statin and the non-statin-lowering cholesterol medication medication, had an absolute risk of cardiovascular events of 32.7%. Those just on statin, 34.7. It was statistically significant, but overall a modest decrease in outcomes.
And at what price? In terms of cost, in terms of side effects, in terms of onerousness of therapy?
Well, the risk of side effects was similar for both groups. They did not assess cost, however. And so you actually bring up two important points. One is, will this somehow affect compliance, that is taking two medications instead of one? And one of the unfortunate things about this study is over the course of the 6 years, about 42% stopped taking their medications. The second is the cost. They didn't address what's the cost of the complications versus what's the cost of the medications.
Exactly. And unquestionably, we're going to be hearing way more about this. On that note, I'm going to reveal that, of course, I'm going to do the cavity shaving and breast cancer this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.